This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Mermaids, Selkies and Sirens, Legends of the Sea.
So before we start, I feel it is only appropriate to wish all of our listeners a very happy 2017. We hope you've had a lovely holiday. I think by now most of you will be getting back to either to school, university, or back to work. So here's to hoping that you've had a good start to the year, if you can remember the start of the year.
Yeah.
Jules hasn't. Jules has been sick.
No, I've had flu. Really proper bout of it, so yay. I'll just be really husky and quiet today.
And apologies in advance if you hear any tooting or sounds of traffic. That's on my side. I apologise. I am broadcasting this from the middle of a street in France. I'm not in the middle of a street, but I'm just right next to one.
Say context there.
Yeah. So we thought we'd sort of ease our way back into the year and into Dissecting Dragons by doing a subject which is beloved by all, because let's face it, who doesn't love mermaids? Other than sailors.
Me, actually. They leave me a bit cold.
Jules, well, I'm shocked.
It's more a case of the myth and legend wise, there are others that I find more interesting or that engage me more. I mean, they're okay, but yeah, they just don't capture my imagination as much. They don't seem to do very much.
No, well, I guess it depends. It really depends on kind of which angle you're looking at mermaids from. I think the other thing is that mermaids do often get mixed up with sirens, and they get mixed up with what are they called? The bird people, the bird things from Dante's Inferno.
The bird people?
The bird creatures. You know, the
you mean female... harpies?
Harpies, that's it.
They were from Greek myth first.
Yeah, I realise, but I've just, last thing I read with harpies inside of them were Dante's Inferno. Mermaids get mixed up with the kind of the lot of them and what mermaids are and what they can do. In particular, I don't think that mermaids actually initially were the creatures that used to sing and drown people. Those were sirens, obviously, hence the name. And so there's been kind of over time, mermaids have sort of developed into what they're known as. But we're not just talking about mermaids today. We are also going to be talking about sirens. And we're going to be talking about selkies because they're some of my favorite creatures from the sort of the Celtic mythology are the selkies.
Yeah.
So, Jules, you have obviously been doing a little bit of research into mermaids, in particular Cornish mermaids.
Yes, this is to do with book three. I will say that no actual mermaids turn up, I would like to point out, but the legends actually are quite handy for giving a framework. There's something when I was staying on a family holiday. It was my mum's 60th birthday, and that's what she wanted to do. She wanted us all to go together. So we went and stayed down in Corsand in Cornwall. And then my dad said, so how's book two coming along? And I'm like, oh, I'm really struggling with it. It's really, really hard, but I think I'm getting somewhere. And he said, right, so book three, you're going to set that in Cornwall? And of course, that meant that I stayed up all night thinking, well, actually, I could do this and I could do that. So not only did my dad make the trilogy into a quartet by doing that. he also deprived me of quite a lot of sleep, so thanks, Dad. But it looks like it might be... it's an interesting angle, and I like it, and I like everything it's tied up in, because Cornwall is absolutely stunning. I don't know if we've got pole dark viewers other than Madeline here. But,
of course we have pole dark viewers other than me, gosh.
But Cornwall is... I don't know, it's got this sort of out of this world feeling to it. And that was really appropriate. So, getting back to mermaids, I was doing a little bit more research about it. I've always had a fascination with the sea, and I've always lived fairly close to the sea, except for, most recently where I'm sort of landlocked in Gloucestershire and the Cotswolds. Though I intend to go back to the sea, as all mermaids do. Yeah, there's an awful lot of mermaid legends in Cornwall. I think there tends to be a greater concentration of Selkie legends up in sort of Northumbria in Scotland, but Cornwall is very much the traditional sort of almost Hans Christian Andersen half beautiful maiden, half silver fish type creature. And here's a selection, and very much like the fairy folk, haha, they seem.
Oh, come on, really? The first one of the year and you deprive me of the H of the F word.
I've eased the way for you.
I'm shocked and disappointed in you, Jules.
I haven't shaken the F jar under your nose, in fairness.
This is true.
But yeah, like the Fae, mermaids seem to be either completely harmless or quite vengeful, depending on how you've behaved. So here's a couple of legends that are a bit different. There's the Mermaid of Zennor, which is a place down in Cornwall, and this is a legend that goes back hundreds of years, and there's a mermaid chair carved as well. Basically, there is a little church called Saint Serana's, and they had a lovely choir, and every Sunday the parishioners would see a beautiful lady who they didn't know at all, who would come up to the church, and she'd join in. She was drawn by the music. She was really richly dressed, and they had no idea who she was. And after a while, she stopped coming, and then she periodically over the years she would just turn up, and basically they noticed that she wasn't getting any older, which kind of freaked people out.
Yeah, that's understandable.
But she was always welcome because she had the most beautiful singing voice. And then eventually, after many, many decades had passed, she basically saw a young man there called Matthew Travella, who was a rather handsome young fellow with a very, very nice singing voice. And the parishioners saw her talking to him outside the church, and then the next day Matthew was gone. And they couldn't find any trace of either of them until the report came in from a ship that cast anchor at Pendawa Cove, which is near Zennor, and the captain was sitting on the deck of the ship, allegedly, when he heard a voice hailing him from the sea. Looking over the side, he saw a beautiful woman with long flowing hair, and she said, "Could you please raise your anchor? Because it's resting on the door of my house and I can't get to my children." Now, that all sounds really quite silly, but being a sailor and knowing a fair bit about, the legends around mermaids and how inventive they get when they're crossed, he raised anchor and sailed away. And when the story came to the parishioners of Zennor, they thought, "Ah, so that's what happened to the mermaid and Matthew. Matthew's gone to live in the sea." As you would, you'd obviously think that. I mean, that's the connection, isn't it?
Obviously.
But either in an act of appeasement or, as a quite cynical tourist trap type move, they carved the end of the pew where she used to sit into the shape of a mermaid, and you can still see it today. And it's a few hundred years old, so it's quite interesting. And that's quite a harmless. That is really quite a harmless mermaid story. If you compare it to the story of the Morwen of the Doombar down near Land's End, or down near the
All right.
Manicles, a mermaid warned a ship's captain not to sail down a particular estuary, because it
But he
was.
went and did it anyway,
He went and
right?
did it anyway, and she was furious, and she sang and raised a storm and caused the Doombar, which is a great long bank of sand, to rise out of the ocean bed and sink the ship.
Well, that's what you get.
And even now, there's legends that if you're sailing anywhere near the Doombar, then you have to propitiate the mermaids. And there's a lot of other legends like this as well. And as I said, I've drawn on the sort of feel of it for the third book, but I'm not actually having any actual mermaids.
But you
Not yet.
often do that, don't you? You've played around with kind of legend. It was like the way you did the Long Lankin without actually having Long Lankin, but you drew on it.
Yeah, I very much like the feeling of it. But I mean, it's funny because mermaids seem on one hand quite silly and almost sort of, you know, flighty, pretty, frivolous creatures, and then on the other hand it's like, oh god, you don't want to piss her off.
Yeah, they are vengeful. It's a it's really silly. I just suddenly had this memory of something I'd read a long, long time ago. It was a manga, and it was one of the omake at the end, so like little funny comics they sometimes have at the end, just to kind of lighten the spirit. And it was manga of Kyokara Mao. And it's this fantasy world, you know, it's European-centric, kind of typical swords, demons, etc. And yeah. At one point they're discussing this creature. One of the characters says, oh yeah, you know, I had a girlfriend like this, and she was a maidmer. And the main character, who's actually from our world and is ordinary, is like, a maidmer? And they're like, oh yeah, half fish, half human. And so of course he's imagining a mermaid. And then it's revealed it's the other way around. So it's like a fish head, giant fish head, but with human legs.
Yes.
And they're like, yeah, it's quite hard to tell how old they are. I mean, you can tell kind of by the legs. For some reason, now whenever anyone talks about mermaids, I get this picture, this image in my head of just like this salmon head, these cold, yeah, dead eyes, and then these like really luxurious, long kind of model legs and high heels. So, yeah. Picture that next time. Mermaids, there is no between, is there? They're either like pure and quite lovely, or they feast on flesh and they're vengeful. And you know, I often think of the way that they did it in Peter Pan. Obviously, you get the mermaids, and Wendy gets too close to the water, and Peter sort of pulls her back, and you know, the mermaids were going to drown her. And there was that element of Wendy never thought, oh, these mermaids will drown me, because they looked lovely and they were all enticing and nice, and they didn't seem vengeful at all, but actually they were just really horrible creatures.
Yeah, I mean, on the drowning aspect, I think traditionally it's sort of held that in some legends that the mermaids are a female race and they don't have any males. So they try and lure sailors to them because, you know, they're after husbands, because obviously you would be, and not realizing that sailors cannot live under the sea, and so they accidentally drown their lovers, so they're quite tragic creatures in that respect. And then on the other side, I think it's been tangled up with myths and legends of undines, which are the water spirits, and undines are known for being incredibly passionate but extremely jealous, so if they see you as a rival, then they will try to drown you, and they do all sorts of other vengeful things, like in some cases I've heard of legends of them bursting pipes and flooding houses and all sorts.
That's nice. Isn't that nice? That's nice.
As well as causing storms and wrecking ships. And
Of course, because why leave it there?
I mean, in the Cornish sense, it made sense for them to play up stories of mermaids, because Cornwall has... and this is, again, something I've drawn on, Cornwall has a long history of smuggling. Dorset does to a certain extent, but particularly Cornwall. And the tides around there are incredibly treacherous. The Solent's an awful tide that gets misinterpreted at your peril. People still drown in it today. When they're out fishing or whatever. And, it made sense, obviously... The time that the smuggling was going on, somewhere between 1635 all the way up until, I think it was 1853, perhaps a bit later. And then it just became... This was all because there were massive, massive, expensive wars going on in Europe. So our aristocracy over here in Britain were taxing everything. So it was quite lucrative to be a smuggler. And people didn't feel bad about paying smugglers for things like tea and coffee, etc.
And salt.
And salt and brandy and, you know, things that are actually, well, maybe not necessities, but definitely wanted.
They talk about it in Poldark, in that they needed salt, because without the salt, they couldn't preserve the stuff that they needed throughout winter.
Yeah, absolutely. So there were obviously necessities, and it's all a bit complicated. I won't go into it too much here, but it made sense for them to try and keep a certain amount of superstition going, or to make the more educated upper classes think that they were stupid yokels, when in fact they weren't. They were robbing them blind behind their backs because they were being, you know, taxed out of any sort of decent lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it's all tied up with like the Jacobite Rising, because the smugglers didn't just used to smuggle goods, they used to smuggle people.
Yeah.
So in some respects, playing up the whole sort of, oh, you can't hear me mermaids thing made sense
for them. Was to their advantage, yeah. It's very interesting to see the other side of the tales. Moving from Cornwall and mermaids, let's talk a little bit about Selkies, because we're in the same sort of region. Let's just cross the ocean. Well, I mean, we also get Selkies, I think, in some Scottish mythology, but I think they are predominantly, is it predominantly coastal sort of Ireland?
Actually, they originate in Scottish mythology.
Oh, there we go. You learn something new every day.
They did come across, obviously. You did get some across to Ireland, but they were more the sort of sea creatures. There were the Celtic sea maids, who would lure sailors out and then eat them because they were cannibalistic.
Always up for some cannibals. So I don't mean that literally, or do I?
You say the most distressing things.
Just to keep you on your toes, Jules. But yeah, I mean, I watched a film fairly recently called Song of the Sea. I don't know if you've seen it.
No,
visually,
I need to watch
fantastic.
It.
You do. You it's a fantastic. I mean, visually, it's really intricate, and there's almost a sense of the Studio Ghibli kind of feel that goes along with it. But it's one of a kind. It's fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. And obviously, you know, you get the Selkie kind of mythology around where you get seals. And we don't actually have seals in many places in Britain and in England. Sorry, in England, we don't have that many seals, really. You don't really see them, except I think you mostly get seals in the western coasts. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah. Some in Cornwall, Northumbria. And Scotland, the Orkney Islands. Orkney obviously means seal.
I did not know that.
Orkneyja means seal islands, which is what the Vikings used to call them.
That makes total sense.
And if you've ever been to the Orkneys, that's another out-of-this-world place where the light's always sort of a bit faintly violet. And it gives everything this otherworldly, misty feeling. So.
And that's the Orkney Islands, is it?
Yeah. Or the Orkneys, as they prefer to call it.
I'm going to go there. But yeah, so that's again a story which is interesting because it doesn't come with the same connotation as the mermaids. Selkies, almost always, I've never read or seen a story where a Selkie is violent or vengeful. They are incredibly playful, and I think most of the stories tend to be man sees Selkie, man steals Selkie's coat, hides it. Selkie becomes his wife, and then one day she finds the coat and she returns to the sea.
Yeah, she finds her seal skin.
And there's different reasons. Some say, you know, it's because actually she's, you know, I think it was originally that, you know, she always wanted to return to the sea and he hid it from her. But then sort of in the newer versions, they kind of make it a little bit less, you know, abusive and just say, no, it's just that's the rules when she...
They're nearly always lured in by music as well.
Yeah.
Curiosity and music.
Yeah. And I think it's an interesting one because when you get sort of mermaids, and if you compare mermaids and Selkies, if we look at sort of horrible mermaids, you know, or like early mermaids, as it were. But, you know, you describe them, they leave you feeling a little bit cold. But Selkies don't give that impression. They don't make you feel cold, do they?
No.
Or do they?
Well, no, it's Selkies are mammalian. The seals are mammalian, so I don't know how much of that is just me, but...
You just don't like fish, to be honest. I don't
do
really
like fish.
Fishy.
They go very nicely with chips.
Oh, ha ha ha, ha 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 ha. They go nicely with rice. All about that sushi. Yeah, no, I'm actually with you on that. I'm not a big, like, fish are cool, but like not that cool. I don't like them, and I certainly wouldn't want to touch one. But like seals, I don't really know anyone who's ever had a problem with a seal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you're a small fish or something, then you might do. But
yeah, but I don't know. As I said, I don't know many small. Yeah, I don't know many small fish, so it's not something I've ever had a conversation with someone about.
But it's like one of my earliest memories is being about 3 years old and being taken to the seal sanctuary in Cornwall, and we used to go to Cornwall every year when I was little, and I saw a lot of seals down there. I always loved them.
Yeah, I think they're great. They're rather lovely.
I think what I find interesting about Tales of Selkies is the crossover between Arthurian myth and legend and Celtic myth and legend with Selkies.
Yeah.
You heard the Ballad of the Fisher King? It's very, very old, as in a couple of thousand years.
Yes, I have, but you go on then.
Obviously, with King Arthur, you get the point where, because he's tied to the land and his health is failing, the land starts to fail as well. And the same thing happens in a much older story, which is the Ballad of the Fisher King. The king is wounded in either his legs or groin, we're not really sure, and becomes unable to perform his duties, and his men go out looking for a cure for him. Now, what does that remind you of?
Can't possibly think.
There's some speculation that because he was wounded in the groin, he actually becomes impotent and can't father an heir as well. They must heal the king in order to continue the bloodline. The Fisher King is actually considered to be a Selkie, or, you know, he was from the sea folk type family originally. He may not be a Selkie himself. And some legends have him saying, you know, I've heard legends where he was hunting and he actually injured a seal, and because he injured a seal, the injury manifested itself on him as well. And then there's quite a fantastical sort of dream sequence where he goes under the sea with some seals as a seal himself in order to find a cure for the seal he'd injured, because the seal was the king under the water, as it were, and only by healing that king can he heal himself. So that's another version of the story. I always quite liked that one, because water in mythology always represents the other world and being able to cross between realms. So if you like, it's going into your own unconscious, your own subconscious, and finding the root of the problem and healing it from there. So in that respect, I've always quite liked it. And there's also something a bit haunting about it as well.
Yes, I agree with you on that. Sorry, no, continue, because I'm going to say something after about the Fisher King.
So, again, there's a lot of parallels between the Fisher King and King Arthur, and obviously King Arthur's knights going out in search of the Holy Grail to heal their wounded king. Interestingly, in the King Arthur legend, it's not so much that Arthur's been physically wounded, he's been dealt a blow to the spirit because his wife has betrayed him with Lancelot, and he's shut her away in a convent.
As you do. So, because obviously there are millions and millions and millions of different versions of the Arthurian stories, and one version is, of course, that Sir Galahad is actually the grandson of the Fisher King, because you have the Fisher King and then Elain of Corbenic, who is his daughter, who is Galahad's mother. And that's interesting as well, because in some versions Galahad gets the grail and he brings it to the Fisher King and he gives it, and the Fisher King drinks from it, is healed, and then they all disappear, which is funny, especially if you know that the whole kind of oh no, we need an heir thing is true, because in which case is they're like, yay, we cured the king, but now both he and his heir have disappeared, so that's awkward, I guess. But the other one is it's interesting because, of course, in some versions of the story, Lancelot is Lancelot du Lac, and he was raised by the Lady of the Lake. And so if you think of Galahad, he's ultimate water baby, because he's the grandson of the Fisher King, and he's the son of Lancelot du Lac. So it's just, and again, we talk about the water being the other world. And if we remove the Christian connotation from the Arthurian legends, and again, and we look across at, so you have Galahad, who is the grandson of the Fisher King, who, as we've just said, might very well be a Selkie of some description, but certainly had a connection with the sea. And then you have the fact that he is the son of Lancelot du Lac, and Lancelot was raised by the Lady of the Lake. So he's the ultimate water baby, because he's the grandson of the Fisher King and the son of Lancelot. And, you know, we talked about the fact that the water is that other world, you know?
Yeah.
And if we move away from the Christian kind of mythology that was placed onto the Arthurian tales, and start to look at some of the Celtic mythology, where we've got the Fomori, who were pushed back into the sea. You know, you have fairies, you have the supernatural being pushed both under the earth, but also into the sea. And the sea, and when you think again, when Arthur dies, where does he go? He gets put on a boat into the sea.
Yeah.
Or rather across, yeah. And so that connection with water is very, very, very interesting. And then, of course, what happens is that Galahad brings the Holy Grail to his grandfather. They both drink from it and then they disappear. But if we remove the Christian element, they both return to the sea. I could talk about it for ages, but it's very interesting how the water and magic are connected.
Yeah, definitely. It was something we were talking about before we started, which is the symbolism used by the Brittany tribes, which was carved onto stones, and you can still see a lot of them carved stones mm-hmm. around Scotland area, which were oddly to do with mermaids as well, which is you can have, there's a sort of like half goat, half sea creature that has a long sea type tail, and the horns and front of a goat, which mm-hmm. again is mastery over land and sea. And the mm-hmm. mermaid generally has a mirror and comb, and I'm pretty sure the comb is to do with royal line, but I can't 100% say that for sure because I can't find the original reference. But the mirror the mirror is to do with the world underneath, if you like, the dark world, the crossing between the boundaries between here and the land of fairy, if you like, or mm-hmm. you know, the land under the water, land under the waves, across the lake, however you want, whatever euphemism you want to use for it, it's crossing the boundaries of reality. That's what the mirror symbolizes. Yeah. So all these pictures you have of mermaids combing their hair and gazing into a mirror has nothing to do with vanity or the fact that they're, you know, nice looking women with fish's tails. It's to do with having mastery over a royal line and being able to possess the magic of that royal line and cross between the boundaries of reality.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what makes me theorise that actually if these stories are connected, mermaids or sort of creatures of the sea may very well be the descendants of the Fisher King.
Yeah, quite often in paintings as well you'll see them depicted with red hair, which is unlikely for a creature that's lived entirely underwater, assuming anything
yeah.
is real. That would be really unusual. But red hair, again, was symbolic of a royal line.
And interestingly enough, little Galahad factoid, I believe that in many references his armour was red. He wore red armour.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, let's move away from Arthurian legends a little bit.
Yeah.
And let's go across the sea and let's talk about sirens.
Yes. I mean, before we get to sirens, one of the earliest stories of mermaids is from Assyria, and mm-hmm. it's the goddess Atargetis, who transformed herself into a mermaid when she accidentally killed her lover, who was human. So that transformative state was actually considered punishment. And there are Celtic legends as well, whereby women who accidentally kill their lovers are turned into Selkies or mermaids as well. So that's always quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Greeks,
yeah.
who were absolute savages, did actually turn women into or imprison them as sirens.
But there is a very long, there are a lot of stories of gods turning men and women into animals, and in particular not just animals of the land but sea animals, because you've got another one which is I think Poseidon turning sailors into dolphins.
Yes.
after they've been blown overboard. I think they've been thrown overboard, and then they took pity on them. And was that Poseidon?
Yeah, I mean, always be careful if you ask the gods for help, because you get turned into a tree or something.
Yeah. I think in that case, they don't necessarily give you what you want. But yeah, Atargatis is an interesting one.
I always felt a bit for Amphitrite, actually. Amphitrite was the original goddess of the sea, and she was a titan. And then obviously you had the sky gods who came along, and Poseidon took over, and she sort of got relegated to being his wife.
Fun times for her, yeah. Because there was also Calypso. She was another titan, wasn't she?
Yeah, that's right.
And she wasn't of the sea, but she obviously she lived on her little island. So yeah. It's an odd thing, because when you look at creatures of the sea, they're not exactly delicate, are they?
Yeah, no.
They're not, and yet. And, you know, I think it's of all things, you know, originally they say that it was manatees. People saw manatees and thought, they're weird humanoid creatures in the sea. Like, those people should have probably had their eyes tested, because manatees don't look that much like people, but okay. But the idea, it kind of bothers me, because you get these images, these beautiful women, and they're all kind of like, they just don't look equipped to be in the water at all. And then you get sort of, especially sea animals, you look at sea fish and sea mammals, and they need huge amounts of fat to stay warm, because it's freezing.
Yes.
And I like some of the, we're starting to see more kind of different types of art, which more sort of, what would mermaids or humanesque, you know, what would creatures look like if they did have humanoid features, but would allow them to actually be able to live in the sea and look like they could actually survive. And the result is kind of terrifying. I think of, as I said, I quite like the way they did the mermaids in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was that mockumentary with the kind of the greenish skin and the, you know, the appropriate looks for something that lives underwater.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, if you're going to have something that lives underwater for that length of time, then it doesn't make sense for it to be, hemothermic. So you're looking at something that is effectively cold-blooded and that has gills, yeah, and isn't mammalian for a start. Because even while we have sea mammals, they don't stay in the sea permanently. They can spend long amounts of time there, but they breathe air. They don't have gills. And obviously they mate, reproduce, rear their young and everything on land. With the exception of, obviously, you've got whales and dolphins and things. But I mean, they do have specialised adaptations when it comes to their lungs. But they do actually breathe air. They don't breathe the water. They're just much better at conserving oxygen. I don't think you really need a biology lesson on how the whale collapses its lung or anything, but
I'd love to know that, but we could talk about
it. Yeah. well, they were supposed to be the daughters of the river god, weren't they? Ascalosh? Mm-hmm. I can't pronounce it, Ascalosh. And the weird thing is, they're actually portrayed in Greek myth as being in their star-flowered meadow as much as they are being creatures of the water. And in the legend of Persephone, they're shown to be companions to the daughter of the earth goddess Demeter, who gives them wings to search for Persephone when she goes missing. So they're not... It's the Romans who really gave them the... I mean, aside from the whole testing of Odysseus, where he has himself tied to the mast so that he can sail past the sirens and actually ends up releasing them from their imprisonment by accident because he's curious, they're not really seen as the creatures that sing and draw men to their deaths in the same way as they are when the Romans then get hold of the myths and repurpose them.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. Anything connected with the river gods or with Poseidon. Poseidon was as much the god of earth as he was the god of the sea, and we do forget that.
In what way?
If you check it out, Poseidon is actually the god of earthquakes, volcanoes, and that sort of disruption. He was basically the god of huge elemental forces. So yeah, the sea was his prop. The sea was his province, but so was the earth.
I love that, because it's just one day we'll have to do an episode all about just the Greek gods, because you just got Zeus, who can't keep it in his pants, and so he's the god of not keeping it in his pants. Hera's the god of cleaning up Zeus's mistakes, not by, you know, punishing Zeus, but by punishing all of his mistakes. And Poseidon is the god of literally just every kind of awful thing that happens. So tsunamis, volcanoes, earthquakes, you know, he's responsible for all of them. And then you've got Hades, and Hades is so chill the entire time. Like, he was actually the most normal, the most sensible of the entire lot. He was actually the best behaved god out of all of them, with pretty much the only working marriage of all of the gods. So there you go. We'll do an episode all about them. So yeah, all right then. It's got to be asked. What's your favourite mermaid story?
I'm not sure. It would be a sort of Selkie legend, probably something like that. Because I mean, to be as I said, they're really only a passing interest for me. They don't hold a lot of influence like other myths and legends do.
Really, you never wanted to be a mermaid when you were growing up?
Nope, zero interest. And I always found the Hans Christian Andersen story, The Little Mermaid, a bit preachy. And quite sad.
That's interesting. Yeah, it is very sad.
I hate the aspect that anything that isn't human doesn't have a soul. So he really got on my bad side from the get-go there.
But, I mean, you know the story behind it, don't you?
Yeah.
Of why he wrote it.
Yeah, no, I've heard the story behind it.
For those who don't know, the story was actually written. Hans Christian Andersen was in love with another man, his best friend. And his best friend was getting married. And I think that Hans Christian Andersen confessed to his friend, who was disgusted with him and basically ran off. And on for the wedding, Hans Christian Andersen wrote this story. And so the whole kind of things that aren't human don't have a soul, I think rather than him sort of putting that in, he was reflecting how other people saw things which were different. You know, so his saying was, well, you know, we can't be together any more than a mermaid and a human could be together, because as far as society is concerned, as far as the world, the church, everything is concerned, well, this is soulless. It doesn't really exist. It doesn't have, you know, it could never go to heaven. It could never be accepted. And so it's incredibly sad. It's an incredibly sad story. And I'm kind of glad that Disney sort of just kind of went over that.
I get it, and also it's the whole sort of a bird may love a fish, but where will they live? But it's not just that, it's all his stories have this sort of Christian preachiness to them, like he's never really made his peace with it. So that's always been a bit of a bone of contention for me with his fairy tales, full stop.
Fair enough.
And as certainly as a child, it was kind of like, no, not really fond of this particular one.
I have to confess, you know, most of my first encounters with fairy tales were probably through Disney films. So, you know, I liked The Little Mermaid, the film. I quite liked that. I quite liked mermaids. I thought they were neat. That was the, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a mermaid. So there's that.
Yeah, there does seem to be this is not a bad reflection or anything. It's just a case of, there does seem to be a subsection of Tumblr who are genuine mermaid enthusiasts and would quite like to be mermaids. Yeah. In fact, there's a mermaid society, isn't there? The Mermen Society.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, they are incredibly popular. And, you know, you get a lot of girly mermaid movies, a lot of mermaid chick flicks about, well, mermaids coming to the surface and trying to live out as normal students, and you know, you get a lot of those. So it is interesting. I remember reading actually quite a good, but and I cannot for the life of me remember what it's called. And it's a story of a girl who's actually half mermaid. And when she goes into the water, she gets a tail and stuff like that. And what happens is that she lives on a boat with her mother. And she's not actually allowed into the water. And her mother says she's afraid of drowning. And so this little girl has never learned to swim, shower. So she's never had the chance to see what she can do. So then she eventually goes into the sea, I think, at some point. And she grows a tail. She meets another friend, another mermaid. And what she figures out eventually is that her father was a merman, but that it is forbidden by law for humans and mermaids to be together. And so what's happened is that she was sent back sort of onto her mother when she got pregnant, was sent onto the earth and was made to forget the fact that she'd ever... she'd gotten pregnant with a merman, and was also she was made to forget it, and was made to have this terrible fear of the water instead. And it was, you know, it was a children's book, but it was actually really, really lovely. And in the end, this girl manages to appeal to it's Neptune or whoever's in charge of the thing, and she manages to get her father back. And yeah, it's a fantastic story. But I remember loving that. I loved the idea of sort of slipping into the water and suddenly being able to move, you know, fast. And because I think an element of it is that there is this kind of, when you're underwater, it is an entirely different world. It feels different. Everything feels different. And I think it's the closest that we will ever get to flying.
Yeah.
And there is something very mysterious about water. And I, you know, I think everyone kind of can't deny it. And I think that even, you know, I like the sea. I don't really like getting into it because it's full of things that could kill me. And I respect that if I sort of ever got bitten by a shark, it's not the shark's fault. It's because I was in the shark's way. And the shark is just trying to do what sharks do. But, you know, it's not an environment that we are built for. It's not an environment in which we can operate that well. But you have to admit, even if you're afraid of the ocean, there is something spellbinding about it. You're very drawn to it. And it does not surprise me that we have so much mythology and so many stories which are attached to the ocean, especially because we know very little about it.
Yeah, that's true. I was just thinking that pretty much in common with all mermaid myth and legends, and it's displayed again in The Little Mermaid, is the fact that, in fact, it's probably strongest in The Little Mermaid, is the fact that that she is subjugating her identity. She's both things. And it's the same with the Selkies. They'll never be completely happy on land, and they'll never be completely happy alone in the sea.
Yeah.
They need the freedom to be both things, and that's something that perhaps is not afforded to them in a lot of the legends, which is why they're quite sad or they're quite haunting.
Yeah.
And it's the same with The Little Mermaid. I mean, the sort of semi-Christian preachiness aside that sort of irritated me, I hated the idea that she basically subjugated her personality and what she was in order to try and please somebody she was never going to be able to please. And obviously that was reflective of Hans Christian Andersen himself.
Yeah.
But that really, really irritated me as a child.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's it is an interesting one. And I think sea brides, as you call them, we have a lot of stories, whether they're mermaids, whether they're... but actually, that is an interesting thing, because you don't very often get stories of mermaids who come onto the land to be wives. You get water spirits that do. But when it's mermaids, they tend to bring men under the ocean to be their wives, to be their husbands. But Selkies come onto the land to be wives instead. And it's quite interesting, the difference between, because I think another aspect of mermaids is that mermaids are never helpless. Even when they're gentle and kind, the most helpless a mermaid ever gets, they tend to, you know, call up a storm and stuff like that. You know, they mermaids are never helpless. Whereas Selkies, in many ways, often are in the stories. They are at the whims of their husbands. They are at the whims of chance of whether they find their coats again. So, yeah, I think we're coming to the end.
Yes, I think so. It's all very reflective of our feelings for the sea itself, I think. All the myths and legends, Selkies, mermaids, sirens.
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with you. And our relationship with the sea is both a provider and also a something which can kill us all instantly. Is very complicated.
Yes, definitely.
So yeah, so this has been our first episode of the year, Jules.
Yep.
It's very exciting. Looking forward to looking at some more stuff when I don't have a busy road right behind me and I can actually hear myself think. Sorry. I guess we should call it and we will speak to you guys. Well, speak at you guys next week. And yeah, looking forward to a brand new year of Dissecting Dragons and more guests, more topics, and we're always open to topics if you guys have any suggestions of things you'd like to hear us talking about or books. Please just drop us a line and we will try to accommodate.
Yep, what Madeline said.
And on that note, catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.